psychological safety is almost the first rung on the ladder. If I feel confident about being myself, the next step is challenging and questioning. That's when we get curious. That's when we start to improve.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Paul Ashcroft and I'm one of the co-authors of the book The Curious Advantage. I'm here today with one of my other co-authors, Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined by Richard Parker.
Pleasure to be here.
Richard, welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast. Could you kick us off by telling us your story? How do we go from teacher through elite sport and onto the world of the Big Four?
Yes, it's not the normal career pathway for a partner in a Big Four. But I fell into teaching. I graduated. I was wondering what I wanted to do. I was fascinated by PE and sport, and I ended up in a teaching job in further education. And I was playing some rugby at the time and had the chance to play some professional rugby. But I absolutely loved teaching, but maybe realized it wasn't going to be my whole life and therefore decided to go and do something else. And actually, that something else brought together my knowledge of sports, my knowledge of education, and went into the Olympic and Paralympic world and had a variety of roles, from setting up the program to help athletes plan for life after sport, going into broader management across sports science and medicine in the English Institute of Sport, and then into a CEO role. And I suppose I was always thinking about, how do I improve myself? How do I take the next step? What might that look like? And absolutely loved it. You know, I was behind the scenes across 9 Olympics and Paralympics. Interestingly, never went to any of them. My job really is, yeah, to make sure that I'm helping to set up the right environments and enable other people to actually celebrate the success at the actual games. And then got to a point where it was time to try and do something different.
That's amazing. I'm always curious about what's behind it. What motivated you to get into all of these different things the first time? I mean, teaching, yes, I understand. But how did you end up getting into the Olympic side of things? What's the drive?
I suppose my drive has always been to try and help improve other people, right? So that's what I really loved about teaching. You actually see light bulb moments. And especially 16 to 19-year-olds, I think, was a really, to use the term curious, they're a curious group because they're trying to work out that switch from formal education into whatever else might come. And some of them were in further education because they found the normal education route didn't work for them and they were trying to work out what was their route. And so you had a real variety of people in that group. When I came into sport, I actually had a sideways step, right? So out of teaching, I went into the pub sector for 18 months. And in what I was trying to do there was help people understand the importance of training to create career pathways. So they had a massive recruitment retention issue. But actually, if you bring someone in, you know, probably on basic wage, train them and then pay them a bit more, and then train them and pay them a bit more, actually, you retain people. So when the sport job literally came up, it was somebody that knew sport, somebody that knew education, somebody that knew training. It was me on a page, and therefore it was an opportunity to be able to go in. And I think once you're sucked into that elite sport world, it's so fascinating because you are surrounded by people who are trying to be the best version of themselves. And ultimately, that results in an Olympics or a Paralympics and hopefully a medal. And I loved being in that environment where you are surrounded by people who are trying to always improve.
Richard, I wanted to pick up on, we'll get more into the elite sport stuff, I'm sure, but I had a question I really want to ask you. In elite sport, a lot of it, particularly around the Olympics, is working really hard, training as much as you can with the support team around you, all with a focus on one goal, on a medal, on a time, on one particular outcome. What's been your learning from people who are in that type of environment?
it is a fascinating challenge because that moment only happens every 4 years. Ultimately, if that is your dream. And of course, you know, one of the greatest examples, I think, of this, I worked really closely with the GB hockey setup for 8 years. And in that scenario, in a squad scenario, you've got 36 players effectively living and training together for 3.5 years. And only 18 of them get selected to the games. And only 16 of them actually win a medal. And so if you think about that mentality, I'm going to train my life, but actually I might not get there. It has to be about the process. It has to be about being involved in something that could result in an amazing outcome. But I'm going to enjoy the journey. I'm going to enjoy being part of something. You know, so if I think about my own rugby playing career, I was never good enough to get to that England level. But I played first team at Wasps, something I never thought I would achieve. And that was okay for me. That was my gold medal. And I loved being part of the process because of all of the other things that it gave me in terms of friendship, in terms of development, in terms of experiences. And I think sometimes you have to try and realize that it is about that process. The challenge is for those people who are really focused on the outcome. And how do you help psychologically focus on other aspects? Because we're not in control of all of those components. What if we get injured? What if the competitors are better, et cetera, et cetera? So helping people to think about that process element rather than always the outcome.
And what's inspiring for me about what you're saying is when you talked about your rugby career and how you played for England sort of once, but you played at an amazing level, far beyond what most people can achieve, let alone aspire to. And yet you say, you know, you weren't international and all that for very long, et cetera, et cetera. But that was enough for you. And this idea that you can aspire to what is enough for you and what gives you that sense of, I've achieved this, I've achieved what I want to achieve, I've taken as much as I can from it, and it's enough, is a very interesting concept. It's not like you have to strive to be the best continually. You say, be the best version of yourself, but you've got to know when you've achieved it for yourself.
I reflect on this more and more, I think, because I definitely had a period of my life when I was working in sport, when I was thinking that becoming a CEO was going to be the thing, right? That's where I wanted to get, and I would get huge amounts of affirmation and kudos and all those kind of things. And then I got there, and of course I realized, well, it's not about becoming a CEO. It doesn't open some amazing door to, wow, this is incredible. I mean, yes, it was great, and I really loved being in that role and in the organization. But it's not a total fulfillment, and having to realize that there are so many elements outside of that. And I suppose, therefore, if I reflect back on it, I could only look at the goal that was closer to me. So I joined Wasps because it was the closest club to where I was living in London, knowing that I wanted to play a senior level, having played at a very good high level at university. And then I realized that I enjoy the environment. And then I realized I could get better. And then I realized that first team might actually be in my grasp and managed to get there. Sadly, then I got injured and lost my contract and, you know, moved on to other things. But I didn't look too far ahead, I think. And I looked to what I might be within my reach and went for that. And then you look for the next thing that's just out of reach.
It's really interesting what you're talking about here, because a lot of these ingredients here about setting a goal, pushing as far as you can, but not being, frankly, absolutely distraught if you don't get quite as far as you thought you did, but stepping forward into the journey is a lot about what makes people successfully curious. And strikes certainly me, Richard, that you are a pretty curious person. Would you say that's true? Has that been part of, you know, what's driven your success?
Yeah, most definitely. I've always described myself as a bit of a magpie. Like I'm really interested in the shiny things in other people's nests. What can I go and find? And a lot of that, I suppose, links to resilience to a certain extent. So the point that you're making there about actually how do you keep going through those different moments. I described my rugby career. I think I was probably dropped more than I was actually picked. So having to be able to cope with those moments and think, okay, well, if I try again, then I might be okay. And I was, you know, and I had a couple of people that were really invested in me and gave me time and the ability to be able to do that. But there were many moments when I thought, I'm not going to be able to get there. So therefore, I think, well, what might be the next thing that's going to enable me to get there? What is my other advantage that I might be able to bring upon, right? I was never the most talented, but I was one of the fittest players, and I was probably quite resilient to be able to, you know, take the next step. And so, yeah, I just, that curiosity, I think, has driven me to be able to think about how I keep improving.
And very noticeably, not being afraid to fail. Or maybe in the time you were afraid to fail, but at least you were prepared to accept that, you know, there is going to be some knockbacks in there. Maybe one of the things that from your career that really struck out is your work with the bobsleigh teams.
Mm.
And that's the sort of thing that I imagine is pretty scary if you have a what we call a failure on, right? If you have a crash or something like that. I mean, for those that don't know bobsleigh, would you like to give us a quick summary of what happens on a bobsleigh or a skeleton?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating couple of sports, right? So skeleton is a sport where you are 3 inches off the ice. You're on a tray on an ice track going at 70, 75 miles an hour down a track head first. Bobsleigh, now they have monobob, has been introduced in the last Olympics or the last couple of years. But single person, two man, two women, four man, four women, cool runnings is probably the easiest way to describe it because everyone's seen the film and they can imagine that that's what it's like, right?
Yes, yes.
So they are both sports where it involves the fastest start, the best technique to drive down, and technology that's going to be able to get you to the bottom. That's what it's all about. And they are both terrifying, by the way. I tried them as a CEO. I thought it was important to try both sports. So I did try both skeleton and bobsleigh. And I mean, amazing fun, but yes, pretty terrifying.
And how did your attitude of building in failure play out there?
So this is interesting, right? Because so I was CEO of the organization and the job was actually to bring two organizations together. And quite frankly, they didn't want to come together, right? They were very successful in their own right. Skeleton were very successful, probably on an Olympic stage. And bobsleigh had a heritage and successful, you know, in other areas and were sort of up and coming and, you know, they're just starting to be more successful. And saw actually that they could carry on their own paths. The job was to really get them to be curious about each other. So pulling two organizations together, yes, there's all of the due diligence and the elements of actually creating one organization and forming a new culture and all those kind of things. But to create that new culture, I needed them to be able to be curious about each other. So to start with, they would only notice the differences between the two sports and actually trying to get them to understand the similarities. So how to manage the differences, but celebrate the similarities. And then you start getting them together. And there's a really great, really simple example. One of the things I wanted to do was to try and make everything better. I didn't want them to look backwards on how it used to be. I wanted them to look forwards on how it could be. And we didn't have enough office space, you know, caused arguments. So I actually tried, let's find a new office space. We've got more creativity and those kind of things. And so we found this new space and there's three rooms. So of course they said, well, there you go. There's the skeleton room, there's the bobsleigh room, and there's the admin staff. And I go, no, no, no. That's where the coaches go. That's where the support staff go. And you go together. And again, they really fought against it, but actually,
oh, I like this.
Really understanding.
You mix them all up.
Yeah, having them both in the same room because then they realize, God, you're really good as well. Oh, and you've got some knowledge that might be useful. And they start communicating. But you had to almost create the environment for that to happen.
Richard's a partner within EY Lane 4. He works with clients to help create performance environments, enabling teams to thrive. He has over 25 years experience as a leader, supporting businesses through change and transformation. Richard coaches and mentors CEOs and executive teams on organizational growth, focusing on financial and professional services.
The thing I'm hearing a lot in what you're talking about, connecting people and learning from each other. And then also confidence coming from like cycles. you talked about in your own life, those kind of, you did things and then you moved on to the next thing, but you took all that experience and you continued to building and grow, but it was in a different context. What do you think about the relationship between, you know, having to go and cycles and practicing and doing it over and over again, and maybe doing it in different contexts, but that idea that you kind of, this is Alain Badiou, the French philosopher, talks about the world is created through cycles of doing stuff. Have you seen that in play? Have you seen that working? How does it build confidence? How does it get rid of the fear?
I suppose if you start to unpick confidence, I definitely didn't always have it. So I didn't necessarily have that level of confidence in school, for example. I went to a school where being good at sport or being clever wasn't particularly two traits that were applauded in school. And so, that definitely knocked my confidence when I was at school. Actually, I put a lot of it down to my gran, right? So my gran ran a campsite on her own. And in my later teenage years and sort of early 20s, I would go down there and spend 6 weeks with her and run the campsite for her. And she was an absolute past master at creating relationships and getting people to feel warm and welcome when they arrived at the campsite, whether they'd been met before and were regulars or whether she'd never met them. And I suppose observing and copying, right, seeing how well she did it. My parents would always say, I took so much from those summers of just absolutely observing and see how she did it. I think that gave me confidence to then try something else. And then teaching, I got the teaching job 3 days before I actually started teaching. I went into a classroom. I'd never been in a classroom before. I'd never taught a group of kids before. And all of a sudden, I'm in front of 30, 16-year-olds. They can be really brutal in those kind of scenarios. And I made loads of mistakes in those first couple of years. But again, I just kept trying to improve. I had a really good mentor at the time. And again, he was really important to me. And I'm still in contact with him 30 years later. But actually having people who could give you that feedback. I mean, 16-year-old kids give you brutal feedback. I had mentors that gave me potentially more helpful feedback that just makes me make sense of it and try and think about how do I improve my own practice. And I got better at it. And then the kids give you better feedback because you're realizing you're actually trying to improve. And then when you see the impact of what you're doing, that's when you start to build confidence and you go, actually, I think I could do this and I'm going to be able to keep improving. So I think there's so many factors involved in actually trying to build your confidence. But you know, it definitely is something that I wasn't born with it. It's something that I've developed over the years.
Richard, when we're thinking about curiosity and being more successfully curious, one of the things that in our research we've found is the idea of community and that you can be more successfully curious by putting the right community around you. What's your experience of that and the role of community in being more curious?
Yeah, it's a great point, actually, and I totally agree. So I was director of operations for the English Institute of Sport for almost 8 years. And my job was two things, I think. On a micro level, effectively, my job was to manage egos, right? So you would have in a room, you'd have an athlete and a coach, a doctor, a physio, a strength and conditioning coach, a nutritionist, psychologist, and so forth, right? And they all thought they're the most important person in the room. And I suppose my job was to help them to realize, actually, we only help the athletes if we work together and understand as a multidisciplinary team, how do we connect to enable that to happen? And so bringing brilliant people together to enable that to happen. And at a macro level, my job was to help connect sports. So I'd spend time going into sports environments and their culture and trying to understand and asking questions to go, why are you successful? What are you doing that enables you to make that work? And then what can I pick up and help take to another sport and go, do you know what they're doing over here? Here's a really good example. And therefore they go, oh, that's good. I want to go and connect with them. And so I create the networks that enable them to be able to learn from each other. I didn't provide any of those answers. I didn't provide any of my thinking, but all I'm doing is enabling others to connect and enabling information to flow. And they then create the curiosity. So I suppose my role was to create an environment where other people become curious.
I love that so much. I really love that idea that you're connecting people and moving information around. And from some of the maths work we've done in the past, we know that when you connect systems together, like imagine you've got some zebra who are faced with a drought, and you've got some lions who are faced with a drought. And suddenly the lions who've been feeding on the zebra are no longer around. The lions have to learn how to eat something else. I know it's quite a gruesome analogy, but they have to maybe learn how to eat some other buck who are in the African veld, perhaps. And the speed with which they take to learn how to capture the new source of food has a direct impact on their survival rate. And this idea of lions, when one learns how to do the new thing and comes back and teaches the pride, it's usually the females actually do the hunting, and they come back and they teach the other females how to hunt the new thing. Those are the prides that survive. The ones where you've got lone mothers and then they don't teach the others, they tend to die off. It's obvious. So this is an incredible thing. And you can map that mathematically. And this idea of knowledge flowing because you're connecting groups up and they're learning from other places. It's such a powerful tool for building resilience and strength and confidence in the system through learning from elsewhere. And I love the way you talk about doing that in the sporting environment. That really makes huge sense to me. It's brilliant.
Yeah, the sports that were successful were the definitely ones that were curious and they learnt from each other. You cross, connect, and accept that you're not going to know all the answers, but actually so this person over here might, and I'm going to be able to learn from them. You know, we have now in the GB systems performance directors and coaches that don't come from that sport, but they have the ability to be able to connect all the right people and find the right information, and I think that's fascinating.
Now you're in a consulting role, which is like working with some of the biggest and best organizations in the world. What have you learned from being involved in the bobsleigh team and the Olympics and all of this amazing experience throughout your life that applies here?
So I think what sport can do, it is a simple metaphor. When I'm talking to leaders about how do they lead organizations. And you're right, I am in a privileged position. I actually spend a significant amount of time in my role with chief execs, with senior execs of major financial organizations. So firstly, ultimately, they are just people, right? I think if it's one thing that we've really taken over the last few years of more working from home and more virtual working, that we see into people's lives and realize that these executives are just people. They're just parents. They're just mums, dads, husbands, wives, they're just trying to do the best that they can, right? So trying to help them. When we're trying to understand complex challenges, so again, some of these businesses have really complex ways of working. Sport can be a simple metaphor to try and understand that. So sport was about fastest, strongest, highest, quickest. And some of the methodology that we use to try and unpick leadership mindsets, to get people to think differently, for people to try and work out what it takes to win. If you can use that metaphor and then add the complexity of the commercial world, then I think that helps people think about, how do I do that better? Because to start with, it can just feel too big. And so what I try to do is break it down. Now, I don't always use the sport metaphor for that, but it can be a useful scenario to be able to move forward.
If we stick on leadership, Richard, which I know is one of your big topics, and you're working with leaders today, what are some of the characteristics that you talk with them about what you think makes a successful leader, whether that's a leader in sports or a leader in a business organization today?
Yeah, I think self-awareness is absolutely critical. Yeah, I spend quite a lot of that time giving feedback and tools, I suppose, to help people and leaders to become self-aware. How am I coming across to other people? What is the impact of how I'm communicating? What is the impact of what am I delivering? How are we engaging people? I really love storytelling. I think it's a classic leadership skill that helps engage people, that helps give people insight into where we're trying to go, what's the vision, and getting people to think differently. And so within leaders, what I'm trying to get them to think about is being aware of how they're coming across, but being aware of how they're going to engage the rest of their teams behind something, and then how you enable them to go off and do it. Because leaders are just one person, right? They can't do it all on their own. So they're reliant on their teams. To do that, we have to get them to feel as though they want to be behind this leader. So it's trying to get them to reflect and ultimately be curious, right? They need to be able to understand what else they could do to try and improve.
Yeah, and to unpack that point around them being curious, what do you see the role of a leader having all the answers versus the leader that's better at asking really good questions? How would you, where do you see that happening? And do you have any sort of stories about where you've seen actually just asking really bold questions is the way to go?
So I'll tell you the story in a second, because I do love a story, as I've just said, right? But it starts with understanding that we're all fallible individuals, right? It starts with us realizing that we don't know it all. And therefore, we've got to try and find out, or realizing the answers are in other people. So I'll give you an example, because this links to the fear of failure point that we raised earlier. So I remember when I was training a group of advisors to help athletes plan for life after sport. And one of these advisors was meeting an athlete for the first time, and they asked me to come along and go through the process with the athlete so that they could observe. Now, this athlete is in a wheelchair, Paralympian. And so we met in a cafe. I sat down and met with the athlete. And my first question was, so tell me about why you're in a wheelchair. And the debrief afterwards, my advisor said, God, I wouldn't have been brave enough to ask that question. I said, well, why would you not? They're in a wheelchair. It is something that defines them about their sport and why they're doing it. I'm really interested in why they are. Were they born with something that meant that they had to use a wheelchair? Was there an accident? Is it something that's been degenerative over time? Because I want to understand what they go through to help me help them. And I think it's just being okay with asking that question. I'm not always going to get the question right. I might phrase it slightly clumsily. I might make mistakes. But ultimately, if I don't try, I'm never going to find out if I'm right. And so I think if you start with the right intent.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, I think if you start with the right intent, then hopefully you can just try something and see where it goes.
I just want to emphasize that, because we often hear on the podcast that it's important to ask good questions. And there's an assumption that the first thing that comes out of your mouth when you have a go is the right question, and people are going to completely understand what you mean. But actually, you're saying that's not the case. Often you can just frame something that's in your mind and then see where that goes, but at least start with the intention of having the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And another skill is also thinking about how many questions do you need to ask, right? Do you have to be the big person in the room? I remember working for a chief exec years ago, and interesting, seeing as I'm now a leadership consultancy, but we were actually interviewing a set of leadership consultancies to come and do a piece of work. And at that point, I was a middle manager. I was trying to be eager and ask lots of questions and show how brilliant I am and all those kind of things. The chief exec stayed quiet all the way through each of the panel sessions. And right at the end, he'd ask one question. And that one question either showed them up to be brilliant, or it made them look, you know, as though they didn't know what they're talking about. And I just thought that brilliance of being comfortable not asking any questions, but then asking the right question. So I think there's different times for different situations. I personally like to think about asking questions because I am curious, but also that ability to reflect and ask the question right at the end.
I've got a question about building in failure into these cycles and learning and practice and doing and having a go.
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier about fear of failure. I don't like failing, right? I think it's important to clarify. I don't like getting it wrong. I don't like it when it doesn't work, but I'm okay with it happening. Yeah, and there's so many quotes out there, right, about, you know, you either win or you learn and all those kind of things. But I do think it's true. But you have to be okay going through the failure. You have to be okay with your own sense of ego And again, coming back to you asked about leadership earlier, I talked quite a lot about ego. Now, actually, if you think about it, the definition of ego is self, right? So it is about understanding self. And if I understand myself, yes, I definitely have an ego, but I hope that I manage it and understand that I'm okay when I look stupid or I don't get it right. But I think a lot of the fear of failure comes from judgment from others. And I don't want to do this in case people see that I am or judge me for getting it wrong. And again, I would still have that in certain scenarios. I don't really go onto social media too much. And I'm sure part of that is the potential fear of failure or the judgment from other people. But I don't need it. I don't need that affirmation. If it's something that I don't need in my life, then it's not something that I'm going to try and do.
That's right. I mean, even for us in the podcast, you know, with a book, you really put yourself out there and you being very open. And of course, you get some haters. Luckily, we've had, you know, mostly really great reviews, but you always get like the haters. I would hate to be one of these celebrities who get all of that all the time. I don't know how they cope with it. Maybe they don't read it. But even the small bits of, you know, the haters on social media cause us, you know, we worry about it, try and address it, try and see what it is. Or sometimes just have to realize, actually, those are people with mental health issues, or those are people who have a valid point, in which case needs to be addressed, or those are just time wasters. I'm with you. I try not to do too much social media at all. And where I am on social media, I try to keep it very bubbled, like LinkedIn, you know, chats and LinkedIn groups and things like that. But that question of being judged and how do we overcome judgment? Because in one sense, I want feedback from people. But on the other hand, I want the right kind of feedback that allows me to recalibrate. But then also, if I'm going to put myself out there and be courageous and confident, I'm going to be judged by other people. How do we get over that, do you think?
It really makes me think again about the leader's role in creating psychological safety. And I'll tell you another quick story and then try and answer the question. So I'd done teaching for 6 years. I'd got to the point where I realized it wasn't going to be the rest of my life. And I was on the senior management team of a college where most of my peers were twice my age. I think I was 26. And I said to the principal, listen, you know, I need to get out teaching. I want to go and do something else. And to enable me to do that, I need to make my CV look different. So what I'd really like to do is set up a consultancy as part of the college to enable me to have something additional to, you know, another string to my bow. So this is what I would do for you. I think this is going to add greater value to the college that's going to then go on to other things, but I'm going to need a term off teaching to enable it to do that.
And was this for the other teachers?
Yeah, this was effectively setting up night classes. The other teachers, yes, would be involved in teaching. I, you know, so myself and a colleague, you know, she was, you know, probably more of the brains behind the idea, and I sort of added a bit of energy. But we did this for a term. We set up the consultancy. That then continues still to this day as a business. I mean, this is now 25 years ago, but continues as a business. It enabled me to leave teaching. The faith that this guy had in me. So if you think about leader enabling me to try something, it may have failed, but he was happy to invest and say, okay, well, I can see the benefit. I'm going to give you time to be able to do it. I really think leaders have the opportunity to create safety for people to be themselves. I want people to bring their whole selves to work. This is who I am. This is who I'm going to try to be. And then if I feel safe, I can then question, I can challenge, because that's where you get to curiosity. Psychological safety is almost the first rung on the ladder. If I feel confident about being myself, the next step is challenging and questioning. That's when we get curious. That's when we start to improve.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book, The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
I'm really pleased you said that, because that's exactly where I wanted to go next, this idea of the first rung in the ladder, because often that's the thing that stops people being curious, right? They don't get beyond the first step, whether that's because of their own fear of failure that something's going to go catastrophically wrong, or whether it's just, frankly, just a big step for where they are in their own life. You know, their other commitments, the things they already know, et cetera, et cetera. And as you say, when we're on the path, then yes, we can try and test and learn and improve. I wanted to reflect back on the bobsleigh one again. Going down a bobsleigh for the first time is probably an extreme example of something that you do for the first time.
Yeah.
Do you have any stories about where, like, how do you go down the bobsleigh for the first time? How do you build the confidence to give that a go?
So first, it's really important, if any of the athletes are listening, the difference between bobsleigh and skeleton, right? Bobsleigh is used as a generic term, but skeleton being the sport where we've won lots of medals in the last few years, right? So I give you an example of probably one of the best athletes I've worked with, right, which is skeleton, and this is Lizzie Arnold. So our only ever, she won two Olympic titles in a row. So Lizzie got selected out of a broad talent campaign. So she was a track and field athlete. She applied to be effectively an Olympian, went through a battery of physical tests. Let's say 1,000 people applied. You know, you then get down to 500. You do another set of tests. You go to 250 and so forth. And ultimately, you then get to 20 athletes. We take 20 athletes and we chuck them down the track. And there's a video somewhere of Lizzie doing her first run and getting to the bottom of the run and taking a helmet off. And they go, well, how was that? And she went, oh, I hated it. But I'm curious to know if I'd hate it less next time. And I just think that is absolutely brilliant. Now, the next time, I think she still hated it the next time, right? But the reason why I think she won two subsequent Olympic titles, I mean, A, she was a fantastic athlete, right? But she was very curious, but also coachable. So she was always thinking about what might the next thing enable me to improve. But she listened to feedback and improved on it. And I think, you know, what a fantastic athlete to come from a completely different sport and then win two Olympic titles back to back is pretty impressive.
It's a lovely story. To bring it back to us non-Olympians, speaking certainly for myself, what do you think stops people in day-to-day lives from just starting out, trying something completely new? What gets in the way? And how do we get over it?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of things. It's easy to become comfortable. So you become happy in a role. You know that you're good in a role. So a lot of leaders that I talk with or work with, they get promoted because they're really good at what they do. So they get promoted and then all of a sudden they're not doing the thing that they were really good at. And they're asked to then lead a group of people that were doing the job that they were doing. And that brings a couple of big challenges. So firstly, they don't necessarily have the skills to be able to lead. Some people do, but not always. But secondly, the people doing their old job might not be doing it as well as they used to do it. And they find that a real challenge of making that transition. So therefore, it can be quite comfortable to stay doing what you're really good at. And so we have to get to a situation where we are okay stepping out. And that comes back to that psychological safety environment again. We're going to step out of what we were comfortable in and try and potentially not do it as well. And so how do we ensure that they're not being judged for not doing it as well? Because ultimately they've stepped out into a completely different role. So I think we have to be able to enable people to step out of their comfort zone. We have to enable them to be able to do that and not be judged for not being as good. But also we have to go back to that first rung, second rung analogy, which is don't try and do everything at once. Try and do the next best thing and then do the next best thing after that. Otherwise, it can just feel a bit too overwhelming.
That's really clear. And that's really lovely advice for young people who on a leadership track or find themselves in leadership positions or want to be leaders. It's like, what would you advise them? How do you get to that? What are the steps you think they should take or things that they should try and experience in order to be future leaders?
Yeah, I think as people are starting out in their careers, they start into job, I fell into teaching. The point is to try and acquire new skills. So build networks, connect with people that are going to bring you different experiences, different skills. And right now, you don't know whether they're going to be useful in your next career move or not, but try it and do it and see if it might. I didn't ever plan to be a partner in a Big Four. I took the next step, and then I took the next step, and then here we are 30 years later, and this is what's happened, right? So ultimately, I think if you are trying to step into those leadership positions or thinking about what your next move is take on those ideas, take on those experiences, because they may well lead to something else. But if you don't, you'll never know.
We always like having a conversation, and we'd love it if you asked us some questions. Then Paul and I will have a go at answering.
So if I'm going to continue to be curious, I'm curious to know, what have you heard from other people that you think that's just a brilliant way of adopting curiosity? Because then I'm going to learn from that.
Great question. Thanks for putting us on the spot there. One of the things we hear more and more and more is about asking better questions, and that your ability to ask better questions is actually also a learned skill.
Yeah.
You can improve it by listening to others, by trying that out, and then refining as you go. And the better you get at asking better questions, the better answers you get, and the more you enable other people's curiosity in yourself. So that's one of the big things that certainly I've been hearing.
One of the things that comes back for me, and we've done like almost 50 of these podcasts now, and there's something that was captured by Pame. She's the head of learning at Kraft.
Oh, Pame is an absolute genius. I think she's fantastic.
She's amazing. And as you know, she did this thing, 50 different types of worship. It was a year of worship, right? And she went and put her, because she travels so much, she went and decided to visit every Sunday, which she would normally go to her local church. She decided to go to a different place of worship and a different type of worship. And all the way really through from voodoo to Hinduism to Buddhism to Quakers, you know, it's just an astonishing experience. But the thing that, you know, when we talk to her, and which resonates so much about curiosity, is don't be afraid to go out of your comfort zone. And also don't be afraid to go into areas that you would never normally go into. Yeah. And it really throws into relief that idea that you might go into a place of worship, which is totally different from your own culture. And that idea of putting yourself into new places and new experiences, a little bit like you talked about on the bobsled team, when you took them into a new environment and how that had impact on the way they were thinking, and then builds confidence as the new kind of patterns work their way out. I thought that was brilliant. And said by other amazing people, you know, like Natalie Nixon, the head of learning at IBM, you know, it's that same thing. It's like, get yourself out and into different areas to build the confidence and to grow your curiosity.
If I just reflect on a couple of points you said there in the answers. So I really love the point about asking better questions. And again, if I think about one of the lessons from working in sport, I'm surrounded by some of the best coaches in the world. And so again, observing how they coach, observing how they use questioning to help athletes explore their own journeys. And when I'm working with leaders a lot now, similar to you, I talk about it being a skill that you can learn, right? So if I asked leaders to pick up three juggling balls and go and juggle, some of them might be able to do it, but loads of them wouldn't be able to do it. But actually, if you take time and you practice, you will be able to do it. And I think it's the same with asking great questions. You might not know how to do it now, but if you practice, you will be able to ask good questions. So I think we have to be able to give people those skills to be able to take it on. And the second reflection on your answers, just that stepping out of the comfort zone, it's a really easy thing to say, but not necessarily an easy thing to do, because it comes back to that, I don't feel comfortable stepping out of my comfort zone. So trying to get people to think about what would happen if you did, actually trying to start thinking about, if I did step out of my comfort zone, what would be the good bits and the bad bits? Because the reality is the bad bits aren't that bad. And trying to normalize and rationalize that a little bit so that people feel okay, because it can be a bit of a glib response sometimes to go, yes, just step out of your comfort zone. I don't want to. Start to unpick it and think about how do we shift a mindset that enables you to feel more comfortable in that environment.
How do you define curiosity, Richard?
I'd probably sum that up in a quote. So it still resonates with me. When I was 15, I read To Kill a Mockingbird, right? It's a school book, right? Mm-hmm. And I loved the quote from Atticus Finch when he said, "What's it like to step into someone else's shoes?"
Ah, brilliant.
And to me, that's curiosity. What's it like to be in someone else's shoes? What would it feel like to them? I'm curious to know. Because then if I have an understanding of what it's like in someone else's shoes, I might be able to see their perspective. I might be able to think differently. And so that's just one example. And now, of course, that doesn't take into all areas of curiosity, but therefore it's a great analogy to think, well, what's it like over there? That's my definition.
Richard, it's been such a brilliant conversation with you today. You've really covered a lot, from how you build confidence, how you work with leaders, how you get people to take that first step and give things a go, from the world of sports, from the world of business and beyond. It's been a real tour. Thank you for the conversation. If there's one thing that you would like to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
God, that's a good question. That's right at the end. So interestingly, where I'd probably start to go is my initial response is to just give it a go, right? To just try it. But as I start to say that, I realize that I wouldn't have always done that. I realize I wouldn't have had the confidence to do that. And so that's partly the answer. But the second part of the answer is to have people around you that are going to help you through that journey. I've been very lucky to have fantastic mentors, fantastic leaders, fantastic coaches that I've worked with. I've worked in environments that have been supportive. And so, yes, give it a go and try it, because you don't know unless you try. But find an environment and find a group of people that enable you to do that.
I love that very much. And as you say, right back to the community that you put around you. Richard, it's been a brilliant conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today at hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audio book copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.